Army colonel who served as Secretary of State, Colin Powell's chief of staff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Would you please identify yourself?
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Please, Mr. Redman, don't put me out in the street.
Community Alliance of Tenants is working to increase awareness in Washington County of the statewide law SB 608 that was passed in early 2019. It limits rent increases and no-cause terminations for residential leases. There is a temporary bilingual English and Spanish hotline set up for Washington County renters with questions about SB 608, rent increases, no-cause termination notices, and/or lease non-renewal notices. Phone number is 503-644-3007. Again, that's the Renter's Right Hotline phone number for Washington County every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. through January 30th at 503-644-3007. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm right in the middle of solving that riddle known as raising the rent.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland Eye Care, a Southeast Portland optometrist providing eye exams, contact lenses, medical eye care, and eyewear from independent designers. Portland Eye Care is located at 41st and Southeast Division Street in Portland and online at eyepdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, tensions escalate between the United States and Iran.
Oregon film studio Leica wins a Golden Globe.
And later, we speak with Secretary of State candidate Mark Haas.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 6, 2020. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Jeffrey Wade. After the Friday morning drone strike that killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq, tensions between the United States and Iran have continued to escalate. Today, huge crowds gathered to mourn Soleimani's death in the streets of Tehran. Iran has vowed vengeance and says it will no longer abide by the nuclear deal that the Obama administration had brokered. President Trump pulled out of that agreement in June 2018. However, the European countries signed on to the deal, kept the limits on Iran's nuclear capacities in place until now. The U.S. has sent thousands of additional troops to the Middle East in response to this news. All the while, Iraqi lawmakers voted to expel U.S. forces from their borders. Conflicting plans have emerged from the White House, with the president tweeting that if Iran retaliates, he has 52 sites picked out to bomb, including cultural sites. Targeting cultural sites would be a violation of the Geneva Convention and a war crime. Defense Secretary Mark Esper says the U.S. will not target Iranian cultural sites. The White House has not released information supporting its claim that the drone strike on Soleimani was necessary, and top congressional leaders are expected to be briefed on the situation tomorrow.
On Friday evening, demonstrators gathered in downtown Portland outside City Hall to protest the threat of war with Iran. KBOO's S.J. Oxendine brings us the report. Our in-depth guest today is Paula Becker, author of the new memoir, A House...
Would you please identify yourself?
Yes, Olivia Catby Smith. I'm the co-chair of Portland Chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America.
Why are we here this evening?
We are here to protest what seems to be a looming re-engagement of war in Iraq, and specifically war with Iran. Trump just assassinated an Iranian general in Iraq last night, which was an illegal declaration of war. They just sent thousands more American troops to the Middle East today to prepare for this, so we are here to stand up against this and say that we don't support this and to stand in solidarity with the people of Iran and Iraq.
All right. What would you say to the argument that some folks would give you that the man that Trump assassinated last night needed to go and he was a very dangerous person responsible for a lot of deaths?
We are concerned with the consequences of that assassination. So the people who are going to pay for that are going to be the Iraqi people. If we send more troops there, if we escalate this and engage in a proxy war with Iran in Iraq, the Iraqi people will pay, and they're the ones who are going to suffer. So we're really just concerned with the consequences of that action, which are going to be massively fatal.
What do you hope to accomplish by this show of force this evening?
You know, I think it's important for people all over the country to stand up and say that we don't support this. And, you know, there's going to be a mass wave of protests tomorrow in cities all across the country as well. It's important for us to show a united front and also to make connections with each other so we can build out a real anti-war movement and oppose this as much as we can. You can find out all of our information on our website, portlanddsa.org. We've got contact information and upcoming events. We have an anti-imperialist working group that works specifically on anti-war issues. So you can find all that at portlanddsa.org.
No murder in the Middle East!
No justice! No peace!
No murder in the Middle East!
No justice! No peace!
My name is Paige Kreisman. I'm Portland DSA's endorsed candidate for the Oregon House of Representatives in District 42. I'm here at the No War with Iran emergency rally hosted by Portland DSA because I'm a disabled veteran. I was an infantry woman in the U.S. Army, and I deployed to the Middle East, and I've seen firsthand the destruction and devastation and suffering that the U.S. Forever War has caused on the region.
Mm-hmm.
And the careless actions of this president have now put the 80 million innocent Iranian lives at risk because of his reckless actions. And it's up to us, the American people, to stand up and hit the streets. Now's the time for us to have solidarity with the 80 million Iranians who are put at risk. Because it's not us here in Portland, Oregon, who are going to suffer the consequences of this president's actions. It's the innocent Iranians and Iraqi civilians that will suffer the consequences of our president's actions. That's why I'm here.
Okay, so what do you think that you can get accomplished with this show tonight?
What we can do is we can show the world, and we can show especially our government, that the American people do not consent to this war, that the American people do not support this war, the people of Portland here do not support this war. This is a war solely for U.S. capital interests. This is a war for money. This is a war that's only serving the interests of the capitalist class, not working class people. The working class people here in America have more in common and have more solidarity with the working class people of Iran than we do with our capitalist overlords here in the U.S.
Okay. How would you answer the folks that would put the argument to you that the man who was taken out this afternoon or last evening, whatever it was a very dangerous man responsible for a lot of deaths, and he would have probably killed a lot more? Do you have an answer for those folks?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a U.S. soldier. I understand this man has killed a lot of U.S. soldiers. But that doesn't change the fact that the president's actions have put us in a more dangerous situation in the Middle East than we were in just 2 days ago. It doesn't change the fact that now the Iranian people and the Iraqi people are going to be the ones who pay the costs for this action. And the fact that this man killed U.S. soldiers occupying Iraqi territory is what happens in war. That's the consequence of an imperialist war. That's what we can expect. We killed a lot of Iraqis as well. But Iran isn't drone striking George Bush in Texas.
This racist war has got to go!
Hey, hey! Ho, ho!
This racist war has got to go!
Hey, hey! Ho, ho!
This racist war has got to go!
Hi, my name is Shoshana Gabriella. I'm here to protest the war in Iran. Basically, I guess there's no formal declaration of war in Iran, but the events that unfolded yesterday lead me to believe that this is a big issue for 2020, so here I am.
All right. And what would you like for most folks to take away from this evening?
I would like for most folks to understand that this is not a left-right argument. It's something that we need to come together on, all ages, all creeds, all races, all backgrounds, like that whole thing. We need to really live by that right now. It's really for our children. I have my own children, so that also has brought me out here. Like, I care about the future in my kids, and I think we all do as human beings, so let's come together.
For oil!
U.S. off the rocky soil!
This is S.J. Oxendine reporting for KBOO.
Presidential candidates from both parties reacted over the weekend to the drone strike that killed Iranian military leader Qasem Soleimani and the continued threats issued by the president. Lily Bulkley has more with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
There's no doubt that Iran will in fact respond. Indeed, they've already vowed vengeance. This is all happening against the backdrop of a region that's on the edge of another major war.
Former Vice President Joe Biden, following the U.S. drone strike that killed top Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani, as well as Iraqi militia leader Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad. Already, the Iraqi parliament has voted to expel U.S. troops from the country, and Iran said it will no longer comply with nuclear enrichment limits from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which President Trump withdrew from in 2018, but which European allies have been continuing to uphold. Both Democratic and Republican candidates have major concerns about Trump's foreign policy decision-making, including former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
An extremely provocative act that both of the last two administrations decided not to do in one of the most volatile and unstable times, in one of the most volatile and unstable places in the world.
Trump tweeted, if Iran does strike back, the U.S. will target 52 sites, quote, some at a very high level and important to Iran and the Iranian culture, unquote. A central message of Trump's foreign policy is stopping endless wars. Democrat Hawaii Representative and Army National Guard veteran Tulsi Gabbard has also made ending regime change wars the center of her campaign.
His policies are sucking us deeper and deeper into a quagmire in Iraq and Syria. Meanwhile, because Trump ripped up the nuclear agreement, Iran is getting closer to developing nuclear weapons capacity. We need to get American forces out of Iraq and Syria now. Trump's policies are short-sighted and there's no end goal or strategy.
As the only other veteran, Buttigieg criticized the president for not consulting with Congress nor U.S. allies.
As a military intelligence officer on the ground in Afghanistan, I was trained to ask these questions before a decision is made.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders quoted himself arguing against the Iraq War in 2002.
Quote, this is what I said back then. War must be the last recourse in our international relations. And as a caring nation, we must do everything we can to prevent the horrible suffering that a war will cause.
Many Republican lawmakers and administration officials defend killing Soleimani, saying it sends a strong message to Iran. President Trump's Republican primary challengers disagree. Former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld responded by tweet, calling the president's foreign policy, quote, midnight chest pounding and threats, unquote. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A Portland woman has been charged with hate crimes after allegedly snatching a hijab from the head of a college exchange student, according to a statement released Friday evening. Jasmine Renee Campbell, age 23, is said to have yanked the hijab from the head of a 24-year-old Saudi Arabian student, tried to choke her with it, and proceeded to rub it aggressively over intimate parts of the student's body. The incident occurred on November 12th at a transit stop in downtown Portland, near Portland State University. The Multnomah County District Attorney's Office issued the statement and said Campbell will face two counts of bias crime, one count of attempted strangulation, one count of harassment, and one count of criminal mischief. The victim, who has chosen to remain unnamed, told Portland police she, quote, no longer feels safe wearing a hijab in public and is relying on alternative methods to cover herself. Campbell was scheduled to appear in court on Friday but failed to show up. Zakir Khan, the board chairman of the Oregon chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, called the incident a tremendous tragedy and said, quote, it's a terrible reminder of how women are being targeted not only here in Oregon, but all throughout the country.
The city of Portland has halted all homeless camp cleanups amid debates on authorizing a new contract for the work. The city council was supposed to vote on a new contract in mid-December, but it was shelved at the last minute. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has openly criticized new additions to the contract, additions the mayor's office says will make the cleanup work more humane and useful to the city. Currently, through the city's hotline, One Point of Contact, every complaint about a homeless person, camp, or RV is tended to by a team of people who judge the site on a variety of metrics, like possible criminal activity, yards of trash, and the presence of drugs or needles, which informs whether to clean up or remove the site. The navigation team also offers water, hand warmers, and assistance in obtaining ID cards and trash bags for those who do not want to sleep in shelters. The program has undergone several changes within the last year in attempts to make conditions more safe and sanitary for people living outside and to appease business owners and neighbors' complaints about sanitary and safety issues. Commissioner Hardesty has argued companies that have been hired to clean up bio-waste should not also be entrusted to act as outreach workers and medical first responders, and that additional contracts may need to be put in place. The contract is back on the January 8th agenda, and according to Oregon Live, commissioners may have found a compromise to restart cleanups on Wednesday.
A small Hillsboro-based film studio beat out competing Hollywood blockbusters for a Golden Globe Sunday night. Leica's film Missing Link took the award for Best Animated Movie, stealing the glory from other nominees including Frozen 2, The Lion King, How to Train Your Dragon, and Toy Story 4. Missing Link is the fifth feature film for the Oregon studio and the first Golden Globe winner. The stop-motion animated feature tells the story of a Sasquatch who receives help from an English explorer as he travels to contact his Yeti relatives. The film features the voices of Hugh Jackman, Zoe Saldana, David Williams, and Stephen Fry, among others, and the film itself was released in 2019, earned a modest $16.6 million at the box office. Sunday's honors are being deemed as a critical boost for Leica, whose previous films have been nominated for Golden Globes three times. Missing Link's director Chris Butler and producer Ariane Suttner were visibly stunned as they appeared on stage, with Butler beginning his acceptance speech with the words, "Well, I'm flabbergasted."
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for two special interviews, first with Paula Becker, author of the new memoir, House on Stilts, Mothering in the Age of Opioid Addiction, and after, we speak to Mark Haas, a candidate for Oregon's Secretary of State. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with occasional rain showers and a low of 48 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 52. Today in history, in 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt gave his 8th State of the Union speech, now known as the Four Freedoms Speech. The speech was a call for human rights, which created a lasting legacy worldwide. It articulated a freedom of speech and expression, a freedom of worship, a freedom from want, and a freedom from fear. The quote of the day is from that speech. Quote, "In the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. That is no division of a distant millennium. It is a definite basis for a kind of a world attainable in our own time and generation."
Former National Security Advisor John Bolton said today that he's willing to testify in the Senate impeachment trial if he's subpoenaed. In a statement, Bolton said, "Since my testimony is once again at issue, I've had to resolve serious competing issues as best I could. I've concluded that if the Senate issues a subpoena for my testimony, I am prepared to testify." As National Security Advisor, Bolton would have firsthand knowledge of the president's dealings and potential pressure campaign with the Ukraine. His statement will likely put pressure on Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to allow witnesses in the Senate trial, which Democrats have pushed for. A subpoena from the Senate requires 51 votes, and with 47 Democrats in the chamber, only four Republicans would need to support the measure to bring Bolton to trial. That said, McConnell is unlikely to change his strategy. He says he will not commit to considering witnesses until after opening testimonies.
A Virginia tribe is using its new federal recognition to protect land it says once housed its ancient capital. With that story and more, here's Megan Kamrick with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. In Virginia, a tribe that won a lengthy battle for federal recognition in 2018 is looking to use that status to prevent construction of a water pumping station. The Washington Post reports the Monacan tribe believes the location, which is at the confluence of the Ravana and James Rivers southeast of Charlottesville, is the site of their ancient capital, Rasawek. This would be the first major test of the power gained by six state tribes through federal recognition in 2018. The evidence for the site serving as the Monacan capital comes from a map drawn by Captain John Smith in 1612. The Monacans were eventually pushed off their land by the English and dispersed to other states, and possibly Canada. About 2,100 remain today, with 500 who live within 70 miles from the disputed site. In 1980, Native artifacts were found when a gas line was dug on site, but they were bulldozed. Since work began for the pumping station, the Department of Historic Resources said the archaeologist on the project had improper academic credentials. The project is currently on hold. A high school basketball coach in Washington was fired after posting a video on Facebook where he said the city of Wapato, quote, smells like natives lighting one up. Wapato is within the boundaries of the Yakima Nation. KIMA-TV in Yakima reports the video prompted a backlash and charges of racism. Nick Navarro was a volunteer coach. He has since released a new video apologizing for his comments.
I should have never posted the video, but more importantly, I should have never said those words. For that, I'm truly sorry.
That audio comes from TV station KIMA. Navarro did not respond to the TV station's request for comment. The governor of Oklahoma has hired an out-of-state law firm in his ongoing dispute with tribes over gaming compacts. The Tulsa World reports Kevin Stitt hired Seattle-based Perkins Coie to represent the state following the federal lawsuits filed by three tribes last week. Stitt insists the compacts with the state expired on January 1st. The tribes dispute that, saying the agreement language calls for automatic renewal. The Cherokee, Chickasaw, and Choctaw nations sued, asking the court for a decision on the language. Tribes say they're open to renegotiating the percentage of gaming fees they pay the state, but not until the expiration dispute is settled. Oklahoma gaming tribes currently pay between 4% and 10% of gaming revenue to the state. The Tulsa World reports it's the second outside law firm hired in relation to the compact. Years of cleanup and demolition could provide some continued jobs at the decommissioned Navajo Generating Station and Kayenta Coal Mine. Cronkite News Service reports the facility's owners expect to employ people for at least 3 years for the decommissioning process and decades more for environmental monitoring. Cronkite reports the Salt River Project, the owners of the power plant, instructed contractors doing the work to give hiring preference to Navajo Nation members. The number of employees will only be a fraction of those working when the plant was up and running. Peabody Energy, which owns the mine, says reclamation of the site will also take several years. Both efforts could help buffer the expected loss of revenue from shutting down the operations. In Vancouver, British Columbia, a new development aims to help the city's housing crisis while also making a dramatic statement about urban indigeneity. The Guardian reports the site on nearly 12 acres under the Burrard Street Bridge is one of the smallest First Nation reserves in Canada and was home to dozens of Squamish families. The village was destroyed more than a century ago. Now the Squamish Nation plans to build 6,000 dwelling units in high-rise buildings for 10,000 residents and bring more of its members back to the city to live. Called Sanok after the original village, the project's design will include slender towers that could be 56 stories tall, with a density akin to Hong Kong. Some members of the Squamish Nation have raised concerns about the tribe's profit-sharing partnership with private developer Westpank, and some Vancouverites are concerned about the height, but construction is slated to begin in 2021. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
As the heated trial of Harvey Weinstein began in New York today, new assault charges were filed in Los Angeles. The former producer entered a Manhattan courtroom this morning facing the beginning of a rape trial, though now, even if he wins in New York, he'll face a second trial in Los Angeles, where he's been charged with four counts of sexual assault involving two additional women. The LA County District Attorney Jackie Lacey said of the case, We believe the evidence will show that the defendant used his power and influence to gain access to his victims and then commit crimes against them. I want to commend the victims who have come forward and bravely recounted what happened to them. If convicted of the new charges, Weinstein could face up to 28 years in prison. Weinstein's trial has been widely anticipated since allegations of assault and abuse first surfaced in 2017. More than 80 women, including many prominent actresses, have come forward accusing Weinstein of sexual misconduct, ranging from unwanted touching to outright assault. Weinstein's defense had hoped to call a detective to the stand to cast doubt on the NYPD's investigation, but at the start of the trial today, Justice James M. Burke dealt them a blow, ruling against it. Jury selection for the trial begins Tuesday, with defense attorneys voicing concerns over impartiality with the new L.A. charges.
A 5.8 magnitude earthquake hit before dawn on Monday in southwestern Puerto Rico after a week of smaller tremblers. The quake struck at 6:32 a.m. local time, just outside Guanica, frightening people out of their beds, cracking and crumbling house walls, and destroying a photogenic beachside rock formation known as Punta Ventana. According to Governor Wanda Vasquez, no one was seriously hurt, though classes at public schools will not resume until January 13th to give inspectors time to check buildings for structural damage. Several houses have been reported to have collapsed in Guanica, as many are built on elevated columns to avoid floods caused by hurricanes which affect the area. Several houses that survived flooding caused by 2017's Hurricane Maria did not survive Monday's quake, officials say. An ensuing aftershock of 4.9 magnitude added possible threats of massive mudslides in surrounding areas. Elizabeth Fanacore, a seismologist with the Puerto Rico Seismic Network, told the New York Times that people can expect to feel more earthquakes over the next few days, considering the location of Puerto Rico's coastline near the North American and Caribbean tectonic plates. The last significant tremblers in the area date back to 1991 and 1999, with magnitudes of 4.0 and 4.1.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 6th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade and S.J. Oxendine. Special thanks to Lily Bolke and Megan Kamrick. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Jeffrey Wade. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. And at 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Stage and Studio, featuring a discussion with the team behind the new play, Blind, produced by the Chapel Theater Collective. At 11:30, Art Focus, interviews with artists, curators, and critics. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use the mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Guest today is Paula Becker, author of the new memoir, A House on Stilts, Mothering in the Age of Opioid Addiction, from University of Iowa Press. The book tells the story of Paula's son, Hunter, raised in a close, supportive, and loving family, who later falls victim to heroin addiction and spirals into a life of desperation and homelessness. Paula and her husband Barry do everything they can to help Hunter while still trying to keep their marriage together and protect Hunter's younger siblings, Sawyer and Lily. Andrew Solomon, a writer and professor of clinical psychology, calls A House on Stilts a remarkable book and an utterly terrifying one. Personally, I would add that it's also an utterly heartbreaking one. Paula Becker, thanks for joining us today on KABU.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Paula, you write early in the book, and I'm quoting from the book here, when Hunter was young, I never questioned my assumption that my love and good care were check marks on a balance sheet, deposits in a bank account from which he and even I could later draw. I tried to be my best, trusting that if I did my mothering job extremely well, he would flourish forever. I think that's something almost all mothers assume, all parents. Can you tell us a little about Hunter as a child?
Hunter was a kid who never did anything according to any of the baby books, right? So what to expect from your 2-year-old?
Yes, I read those.
You know, he was my first, so I thought, well, gosh, these books are just, they don't know what they're talking about. But it was really that Hunter was just a very unique and sprightly and vibrant little person. He walked at 9 months old. He slept very little as a baby, which was challenging for a first-time mother to come up to speed with that. And he loved, you know, climbing really high, and he was very daring and physically brave, and he read really early, and he was curious and just a really, really deep intelligence in a bright little person.
Now you write in the book, too. I was wondering, when you started getting signs that Hunter was not flourishing as you expected, you write, people who knew Hunter described him as extremely likable and equally intense. Intense meant this: Hunter had the quality of a lost person or someone without a map, even when he should have had one. Even when he was experienced in a situation, he often acted as if it were new or unknown, and that's probably something that wasn't in the baby books growing up. How did you react to that? Did you figure that was just who he was?
Yes, at the time, absolutely. And you know, that passage that you just read, I was thinking as I was listening to you reading it that, of course, I had the benefit by the time I wrote that of, you know, hindsight over his whole life. And so whereas that aspect of feeling like things were new even when they should be experienced for him, that is a summation of sort of a pattern that I saw at the end of his life. You know, I could recognize it once I had a little distance. At the time that he was a kid, you know, we thought, well, this is just how Hunter is, and we will encourage him to, you know, develop more foresight, or, you know, remind him that this is something that happened before. And in particular, he was really easily frustrated when Sawyer, his younger brother, you know, wouldn't play along with whatever particular scheme or game he had. And Sawyer realized that, and kind of, you know, that was a powerful thing for him. And we would tell Hunter, you know, don't let him get your goat, and you're giving him your goat, we would say, because it really was like he was just saying, you know, take it. And so, you know, part of that is parenting. You try to teach a kid, and you have a teachable moment, and you say, okay, what did we learn from this? And, you know, it wasn't anything that was so obvious that at all that we thought, well, there's something wrong here. But in retrospect, I think that there were aspects of that that led Hunter to be less cautious about a lot of the decisions he made as a middle teenager. And that was something that ended up being very, very bad for him.
And one of those decisions he made when he was a middle teenager was starting to use opiates when he was in high school. And apparently the disappearance of Reynolds wrap or aluminum foil kind of got your suspicions up. What was the connection between that, the aluminum foil, and finding out about Hunter's using?
Well, you know, we had been struggling from about his sophomore year with issues of his truancy. He was so smart. So if he liked a class, he would go and he would get really good grades. If he didn't like it, he would blow it off. And we did this kind of cat and mouse game that had to do with where he was in school and if he was there. And then, you know, he was hanging out with kids that we didn't think were very good for him. And clearly he was smoking. And then sometimes he was drinking and he was sneaking out. So we had been these things that some teenagers use to test the boundaries, he was using full force. And by the time he was a senior and we started noticing that the aluminum foil was disappearing and smelling this kind of funny, weird smell, although we could never find him producing that smell, we realized eventually, finally, I realized after kind of Googling my way into Reynolds Wrap, burned, you know, and he had written this word fen on pieces of paper that I would find when I searched through his room, as I frantically often did. And I realized that word meant fentanyl. Now, this was 2010. Fentanyl was not something that was on really anybody's radar at that point. It was not, you know, at the now this illicitly manufactured fentanyl that's being mixed with heroin or that's been being made into, you know, fake oxycodone pills and killing people. That was not yet happening. So this was a medical grade fentanyl, as we eventually learned from probably patches that are used for people who have for palliative care for people and for animals at end of life stage, and they were cut into pieces and sold and smoked, basically, and that was what the Reynolds Wrap was for.
You write in the book, absolutely
horrifying.
You write in the book that since they were cut into those patches, you never knew how much of a dosage you were getting. It could have been very little. It could be almost an overdose at times.
Exactly. Well, it easily could have been an overdose, and I learned that, you know, in the course of writing this book. At the time when we found out, we weren't even sure exactly what the method of getting the fentanyl onto the Reynolds Wrap was. When I was doing the research on the book, and my editor at University of Iowa Press encouraged me to really dial down on, you know, some of the specifics of things that when they were happening to us, I didn't care where he was getting it. I just wanted to get him into rehab, right? But then now you can go back. And so I talked to the people at the University of Washington who study those things, and they were the ones who explained to me, these are timed release, so you might get a little, you might get a lot. So it's extremely dangerous thing to do.
Now, that discovery when you first found out about the fentanyl and Hunter started using opiates, again, you tried to get help for him, and it was a very costly process, which you go over in the book, both financially and emotionally. Hunter, unfortunately, continued to relapse, often into periods of homelessness. Paulie, you wrote so vividly about that I really felt in your shoes each step of the way, and I think most readers will. And it was hard enough just reading it, and I can only imagine how excruciating it must have been to live through it. How did you and your husband, Barry, get through this?
You know, I think the fact that we had each other was enormous. We were intent on trying to help Hunter, absolutely, but we were just as intent on trying to protect his younger siblings from just the absolute blast of all of this coming at them. And I think we were as successful as we could have been. The other thing is that Barry and I, you know, we would take turns on who was sort of dealing with specific hard things about Hunter at a certain time, and also we agreed really probably 99% of the time on what our actions should be. And for example, you know, the idea of putting him out of the house when we discovered that he was using heroin in the basement after he had relapsed, after going away to his first inpatient rehab, you know, Hunter knew that if we said you cannot use this drug in this house, you have younger siblings and it is illegal, you know, your father has a medical license. I mean, Barry's a doctor. Like, you cannot have someone, you know, doing that in the house. Did we want him to be on the street? We absolutely did not, but he couldn't do that in the house. And we didn't have to do more than look each other in the eye, and we knew that that was our decision, you know. And I think a lot of couples who go through this the issues that come up around the child's addiction split the parents from each other. And with Barry and me, that didn't happen. And I realized what a blessing that is.
Now, after you did tell him that he couldn't live in the basement anymore and not to come back home until he cleaned up, there were a few times when he did come back and you let him in. There was one time when he was very sick and you kind of nursed him back to health. And then after he recovered, he was on his way out again and you asked him, will you be back? And he answered, Mom, I don't think I can. And that was extremely heart-wrenching for me just reading it. It seemed like he knew he couldn't change, he couldn't escape. Did you also feel that hopelessness at that point, or was hope always there for you?
I felt a lot of despair, and at that moment I felt quite despondent, but I always had hope too, because I knew that Hunter was a really smart person, and I knew that he was deep and he was thoughtful. I didn't understand nearly as much as I came to over time about addiction and how insidious it is, an opioid addiction, and the way that it affects a person's brain. But I feel like the hope was there. What I didn't understand early on was that there was nothing I could do to make him decide to, stop using drugs or to go into treatment or to abstain from using them, that had to be a decision that he had to make. And that was when I finally realized that, I actually had more hope then, because I knew that I had been doing everything I could do and it wasn't working. And it's like, oh, Hunter has to make that decision. Well, I can just be with him and love him. And the whole time that he was, living on the street or he was in different sober housing places, we were always in contact with him. We were always seeing him and talking to him, sometimes multiple times a week. He was always on our cell phone, and he always knew that if he was ready to try to get clean, that we were ready to help him. So it wasn't that we said, you've got to go out and do this on your own. We were willing to offer him a certain kind of help, and he was for a long time not willing to accept that kind of help, and that's a really hard thing for a parent.
Now, you mentioned in the book, Paula, that Hunter was born in late January. I think that was 1992.
February 1st.
Oh, February 1st. Okay, which means he has a birthday coming up in a few weeks. Yeah. I was wondering, do you and your family do anything special on that day to honor?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked me that, because I do something. I have a personal kind of a ritual that I developed the first year after he was killed. And I wanted to focus on his birthday on childhood and what was good and what was happy in his life. And so we used to go to lots and lots of parks around Seattle. I wrote for a parenting magazine, and I was always taking the kids to different parks. So what I do is I go to a store that sells little polished rocks or crystals, and I buy some hematites, because he loved hematites, those kind of silvery metallic rocks. And then I buy amethyst, because those are his birthstone, and I take in about four or five of them of each one, and then I go to parks around Seattle where Hunter played, and I find a place where I don't think a little kid who's going to choke on a rock is going to find it, but like an older kid, like up on a slide, and I leave the rock and I say, this rock is in memory of Hunter Brown, who played here when he was young. May the child who finds this have a blessed life with little pain and much joy. And that's the ritual that I do on his birthday every year. And I just bought the rocks yesterday, so I'm all ready.
Well, Paula, thanks so much for talking with us. I know it's a difficult subject, but it's a wonderful book. And thank you for sharing Hunter's story in that book and with us at KBOO today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you asking me about it.
We've been talking with Seattle-based author Paula Becker about her new memoir, A House on Stilts, Mothering in the Age of Opioid Addiction, from University of Iowa Press. Paula will be reading and signing books at Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland tomorrow, Tuesday, January 7th at 7:30 p.m. You can learn more about Paula and her work online at paulabecker.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth. Our next in-depth guest joining us live in the KBOO studios is Mark Haas, currently an Oregon State Senator from District 14 in Washington County. Mark's known for being the tax expert in the state Senate and was architect of the recently passed Student Success Act, which establishes a corporate activity tax to fund grades K through 12 education. Mark is now running for Oregon Secretary of State in the election coming up this November. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today at KBOO.
It's a pleasure to be here on KBOO, one of the last bastions of locally owned radio, and I'm very proud to be here.
And we talked before we went on about how you started in radio.
Started in small radio stations,
yeah.
So I have an affinity
for the media.
Yes.
Now, Mark, you've had a very productive and successful run in the Oregon State Senate, and this goes back to 2008 when you first got elected. What inspired you to enter the race for Secretary of State?
Well, it was really the same thing that inspired me to get into public service to begin with. I grew up in this state, and while I was a journalist here at KATU and other places, I noticed during the 1990s that the values that I grew up with in Oregon had been eroded, and especially to education, where a series of tax cuts had gone through. And so I ran in 2000, 2001, and got a seat into the Oregon legislature and tried to turn back those eroded values and to try to right the ship on education. And so that has brought me full circle to this law that you just mentioned, the Student Success Act, that passed in 2019. And I think it did right that ship. We are now going to be putting more than $1 billion a year into K through 12 education, and that gets us back to where we were in the beginning. And then the burden on the tax burden on business now goes from the bottom up to in the 30s somewhere. And I think it was fair and appropriate, and that feels like a completion to the work that I set out to do in the legislature. And this job kind of plays to my skill strength as a journalist and accountability and election security and campaign finance reform, and that's why I'm running.
And we'll talk about some of those. I think most people know, at least what little I know about the Secretary of State, you're responsible for overseeing elections in the state. But that's not all the Secretary does. Can you tell us about some of the other responsibilities?
Yeah, a lot of people are surprised to find out that there are some rather quirky constitutional requirements of the Secretary of State. One is the one that you mentioned, the overseer of elections, which means the Secretary of State is in charge of all of the elections in Oregon and in charge of the 36 counties and the county elections officials, and has to make sure that everything runs smooth and that make sure that our elections are secure, which didn't used to be such a big deal as it has become in the last few years. And so I've been working on some proposals, some ideas to make our system more secure. We're lucky in Oregon because we have vote by mail. And because of that, we're sort of protected from massive voter fraud, because as we always say, you can't hack paper. But we do have some issues relating to our database of registered voters, 2.8 million people in that database, and we need more protective firewalls than exist now. And I'm working with some people to figure out how to do that, because we don't need to be just one step ahead of the meddlers or the bad guys. We need to be about 10 miles ahead. And so that's very, very important for the Secretary of State. But there are some other jobs required for this office. One of them is you're the auditor of public accounts, as it's delineated in the Constitution in that quaint 20th century language. And that means you have to check and make sure that at your discretion, state agencies are running the way they're supposed to be, not just that the money is spent wisely and the balance sheets add up, but that the intent of the laws and the programs are being followed, that there is no discrimination, that ethics are being followed, that standards are being met, and all those kinds of things that don't necessarily have to do with money, although that's a big part of it, but just to make sure everybody's on the same page. And the audits division is the biggest division in the Secretary of State's office. I think there are 75 auditors down there now. And the Secretary of State has a discretion of saying, okay, let's look at this. And then the auditors take over. And once the auditors take over, the Secretary of State lets them do their job if the Secretary of State is doing his or her job.
Now, I looked this up, and one thing you didn't mention, and it's extremely important, you're first in line if something happens to the governor. That's actually how Kate Brown became governor when Governor Kitzhaber resigned.
Well, that's true, and that did happen, and it's in our memory banks because it just happened, I think, 4 years ago.
Right.
But in Oregon's history, 160 years or so...
Hasn't happened often.
It's very, very, very rare.
Now, let's talk about... you mentioned voter fraud. First of all, I wonder what the incidence... is there any data on the incidence of voter fraud in Oregon?
No, it doesn't
seem like a big problem.
We don't have any, but we have increasing incidences of misinformation, which is becoming a huge problem. For example, in the last election... someone reported and put on Facebook, and it started picking up and going viral, that election ballots were already being counted in one of our counties in Eastern Oregon.
Social media is able to, and
a couple of these rumors started, and a few employees in the Secretary of State's office just kind of chasing down these rumors, and it was not an effective way to deter that. And so we're working on some strategies to deal with intentional misinformation during elections, which is unfortunately become a trend, a thing, and but there are like all other security measures, there are ways to deal with that, and we're working on that.
Now, one thing that Republican Dennis Richardson was the last elected Oregon Secretary of State. Tragically, he died in office, so there's somebody else in that position now. I kind of liked him, but I heard a lot of good things about him. But since he was a Republican, I was very suspect, because all over the country, there's these Republican secretaries of state doing things like cross-check, kicking voters off the rolls, eligible voters, making it very difficult for them, and in a way seems to be tipping the scales away from a more democratic process. That always concerned me about this happening in Oregon, and some people might feel... maybe Republicans aren't well represented here and do something to change that. Is that something that you intend to address as Secretary of State? Again, I think we have one of the best systems in the country, mm-hmm. this vote by mail and the voter registration.
Well, the Constitution is the document that makes it partisan. And unless voters change that to make it nonpartisan, I think we're left with a partisan system. People who know me as a pretty independent straight shooter. Regardless of my party affiliation as a Democrat. I've heard some of those criticisms against Dennis Richardson. I knew him in the legislature. I liked him too. I don't think he was ever criticized for trying to mess with voters or elections.
And I don't mean to imply that. Since he was Republican, there's a lot of pressure placed on members of that party to do what the higher-ups want them to do.
And I think you're going to get that regardless of who is in there, because there are a lot of discretion. Like, depending on an audit you may or may not do, someone could say, well, sure, you're going to go after the schools because Republicans don't like schools, or you know, whatever the D subject line is. And so I just think that it's imperative that Oregonians represent someone to this office that they know is independent and that they know they can trust. And if you go back in my career, 18 years as a legislator and many years before that as a journalist in Oregon, they know they can trust me.
Now, some of the issues that the Secretary of State, the new Secretary of State, will face, one of them is currently the Democratic Party doesn't allow unaffiliated voters participating in the primary election process. First of all, why enact a policy like that? What are the benefits? What are the drawbacks?
Well, there are some drawbacks. I have asked the Democrats officially to open up the primary to non-affiliated voters. Not Republicans, not independents, but non-affiliated. And that's because this is now the largest category of voters in our state. 41% of all Oregon voters are not affiliated.
I mean, they haven't declared Democratic, Republican, or independent parties.
So we have a bigger category there than either of the two parties. There's 34% Democrat and 25% Republican voters in the state. So I just think at some point we have to meet these voters where they live. And it's true, these voters could just register to be a Democrat. But it's funny, I talked to some of these voters, and you'd be surprised to know that some of them are Bernie Sanders supporters. And if you tell them, well, why don't you just register to become a Democrat, they'll respond, I don't want to be a Democrat. I don't want to be a part of that organization. I just want to vote for my guy. And so I don't know what the right breakdown is. It's 40%. Now it's 41%. Do we wait till it gets to be 50% and hardly any registered voters left?
Right.
And when we deal with this, and this really feels like a massive conversation for the entire state to have, is how do we get more people to participate in these primaries? Because right now we're closing the majority of voters out.
Now, one thing, we talked again about this before we sat down at the mic. The election in 2020 is extremely important for the Oregon Secretary of State, who's ever elected, because of the redistricting as a result of the 2020 census. What are your thoughts on that and plans based on the census data coming around?
Well, I'm the only candidate that's running that's not been in not one but two redistricting sessions. My very first one in 2001 was a redistricting session, and it was very, very, very intense. We were lucky in that session because there was a feisty band of Democrats in the House, including Deborah Cafori, Jeff Merkley, myself, Betsy Johnson, that prevented a Republican gerrymandering scheme from going through. And at the time, Republicans controlled. And had we not been able to do that, Oregon would have been no different than North Carolina, Wisconsin, some of these other states that have been in courts for years trying to undo that. And so I went through that one, and then again in 2011, when the legislature got together in a bipartisan way, this was when the House was a 30-30 even split, and passed the redistricting maps on its own without having to go to the Secretary of State. And that is the preferred method. That's the method that's called for in the Constitution. I hope that method occurs again. I hope that same outcome occurs again in 2021. If it doesn't, the Constitution says then it falls upon the Secretary of State.
You would be the arbiter, but hopefully you would stay out of that and legislature could come to an agreement.
But I'll be ready. Yes. I'll be there with my maps. The software on these redistricting sessions are just absolutely amazing, and I'll be ready. And the pressures on redistricting are just incredible. And we will likely have a sixth congressional seat in Oregon, and we will need all new congressional boundaries and, of course, all new legislative boundaries. And so I will be ready.
Now, the Secretary of State, in addition to everything we've talked about, I mean, it's an incredibly complex job, also has some sway over social issues. Can you tell us how you would use the office to address, say, issues like child welfare and drug addiction issues?
Yeah, I can do both of those. For whatever reason, tragically, at least for the last 20 years since I've been in the legislature, Oregon has a terrible record of taking care of kids in its custody, like foster kids. And I think the Secretary of State, as an independent agency, should house the Child Care Ombudsman Office, the investigative office, because structurally, when it's in the same agency that's delivering these services, it's hard to check and have any kind of check and balance. So I would establish a Child Care Ombudsman's Office in the Secretary of State's office. As for addiction recovery, I think this touches close to home for a lot of Oregonians. I don't think most people have to go too far before they know of a friend or relative who's got an addiction problem.
Our last guest lost her son to drug addiction.
Oh my gosh. Well, there you go.
The pre-recorded in-depth.
There you go. I lost a colleague at my private sector job last year in an overdose. And there are recovery services out there, but they're all like uncoordinated. They might work in Pendleton, they don't work in Portland. There's insurance plans out there, but they also vary. And what we really need is to coordinate and integrate these recovery options and get on top of this thing, because it's one of the biggest killers in Oregon.
Now, Mark, how can people find out more about your campaign, and if they like what they hear, help support you?
Yes, thanks. MarkHass.com, MarkHass. I want to define myself in this race as the person who has more of the policies and proposals and ideas. And so on my website, I do have five or six policies relating to things like taking care of kids and primaries and getting more voters into the system, same day registration. And so that's all there. And I appreciate it. I told my wife, win, lose, or draw, I'm going to be the one candidate with the new policies and new ideas in this campaign. So I encourage everyone who appreciates that and to step forward, and I'd love to engage everybody.
Well, Mark, thanks very much for talking with us at KBOO today and coming into the studio.
You betcha.
It's like old times.
Yes.
We've been speaking with Mark Hass, the state senator from District 14 and current candidate for Oregon Secretary of State. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. The time is 5:58. Up next, Labor Radio.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Hi, I'm Shahid Hamid, KBOO board member. Join the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Radio as we pay homage to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is the 35th anniversary of Keep Alive the Dream. Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center. This year, we will be joined by international opera star Angela Brown and straight from America's Got Talent, Danielle Damon. That's Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Or listen live on KBOO Radio or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hola. Welcome to the Coalition of Black Trades Unionists segment of Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, here on KBOO 90.7 FM, where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. My name is Tina Turner Morfitt. I am a member of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Retirees Union, and the president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Tonight, I'm joined by my sisters in the struggle.
Good evening. This is Deborah Hall, soon to be retiree from American Federation of Teachers, and I'm currently at this time serving as the Secretary Treasurer for the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Happy New Year.
Hi, I'm Dr. Audrey Terrell. I am the Vice President of the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, and I'm also President and CEO of the Dr. Audrey Terrell Institute, and I'm retired from the UAW staff out of Detroit.
And hello, my name is Nanette D. Carter Joffrey, and I am a proud union member of Service Employees International Union and a Home Care Council District 1 director and also a Coalition of Black Trade Unionists.